We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
I was born on August 15th, and before the advent of Facebook, the only badass I was aware of who was born on this day was the French military and political genius Napoleon Bonaparte. But now with Facebook, I met a second guy, a jiu-jitsu warrior, a 2010 and 2013 no-gi world champion, American-born and American-trained, Justin Rader. Thanks for talking to me today, man.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Let's talk a little about ADCC this year. You had an amazing performance. For those who don't know, ADCC is a very prestigious submission grappling tournament. You won bronze, beating the 2013 world champ in the gi, Augusto Mendes Tanquinho. Then you had an amazing match with Cabrinha, and also finally had a match against João Miau for the bronze. But first, talk about the training camp leading up to it. I saw it was very intense. What was your daily routine like leading up to ADCC?
You know, the ADCC is, you know, like you said, the most prestigious tournament. And I was very happy to finally have a performance that really shows the kind of work and effort and level that I've always believed myself to be at. It was my third time to go and be invited. And the first two times, you know, I would go out and do great and win my first matches. And then I ran into the eventual winner each time in Rafael Mendes and went out usually in that round. So it was really nice to have a showing that I thought really put on a display a true what I really what, like the level that I believe that I'm at. And so that was really nice. The training camp leading up to it was, for a lot of reasons, probably one of the most difficult that I've ever had to go through. You know, every day presented its own, a new challenge. We took everything to a whole new level. And each one of us had different challenges, me and the rest of my team. My instructor was also invited, Professor Rafael Lovato Jr., and then my other teammates, Professor James Popolo. He won the trials, as well as my other teammate in Jared Dopp, who when he won the trials, was only a blue belt. And he's now a purple belt. So for each of us, it kind of presented its own challenges. And, you know, for me being my third time, like, you know, going in and training hard and learning new games wasn't really the obstacles or even mindset for me. It was about just making sure that you know, I was doing everything right and staying more mentally tough throughout it. So, like, we were you know, some of the routine – we were training probably two or three times every day at least. We would have a hard strength and conditioning session usually in the morning, followed by either a mid-afternoon or late evening hard training session.
There must have been days where you were like mentally and physically like exhausted by it. Do you listen to your body on those days, or do you just tell it to shut up and grind through it?
Absolutely. You have to do a little of both, especially training for a tournament like this, especially in my aspect, as well as Professor Raphael's. You know, we also had the weight aspect to worry about. So, you know, not being able to eat, you know, like anything and everything we wanted to completely recover from each one. Of course, there were times that we definitely, you know, had to take it lighter on some days than others. And, you know, pretty much every day we trained twice a day, Monday through Friday. And then we'd have one long, hard, grueling 3.5 to 4 hour training session on Saturday. And, you know, so going throughout that, and then some days we'd train even three times a day. Usually like we'd train in the morning. That's when our strength conditioning was. And then like on Tuesdays, we would have our own special wrestling session. And which I'll go ahead and say was my favorite practice of the week. And then, of course, we'd have the hard training sessions of sparring and doing what we wanted to work on and our hard drilling in the evening, you know. So, obviously, you know, some days working with our strength and conditioning coach, Luke Tyree, you know, yeah, we'd go in there, like, usually Monday, because we'd have, like, Sunday off to rest and recover. So going in Monday, like, you know, we'd be hard, we'd be feeling great or whatnot. You know, by about the time Wednesday came around, you know, we'd have to turn it down a couple of notches, you know, do more of a, like, light movement, you know, kind of workout recovery. But going there and being there and being in the routine, especially for me, was very important. I didn't suffer any injuries throughout the training camp the way that my other teammates did. They had to battle through a lot of injuries. I stayed perfectly healthy throughout it, which to me is actually pretty remarkable considering, like, you know, a lot of my training came from training with them, and they're all, like, quite bigger. A few weight classes bigger than I am. So, but I was able to remain healthy throughout training camp, which was great.
That's an interesting question, is especially from the stand-up training and wrestling. So I've myself wrestled on judo and do jiu-jitsu. You know, the stand-up training can often lead, is a higher chance to lead to injury. So how do you try to prevent that kind of injury in a intense training, you know, in a hard training camp?
Man, you know, sometimes injury is just unavoidable, and there's nothing you can really do about that. You know, I agree with you when you talk about stand-up and takedowns. You know, that's probably has a much higher percentage of being, you know, causing a lot more injuries because it's a lot higher impact, it's a lot more powerful, it's a lot more physical, and it's a part of the game that honestly I think is the most neglected in this sport and art. And when I say that, it's not the sport or art in itself that neglects it, but I think people neglect training it when, you know, every match does start on the feet and you do get points for takedowns and that kind of thing. So that's just my own personal opinion. And it might be for that reason, you know, especially when you get older and you get to a certain age, you don't want to, you know, it's more tasking on your body as well, like, and even cardio wise, getting, you know, no one even likes to drill takedowns, you know, because you're taking someone down and you're having to get up and drive them back down again and get up and, you know, that kind of thing, where, you know, a lot of people probably think it's easier to just kind of lay on your back and
exactly,
you know, put someone in an arm bar. And so, yeah, you probably do have a lot higher injury percentage in that area in regard. And it's probably why, like, you know, we only did like a strict, like straight wrestling a training session for about an hour and a half, 2 hours, one day a week. Right. And then, of course, on Saturdays, we do a lot of our hard training, where we do a lot of rounds, starting from the feet or whatnot. We drew a lot of the different situations and scenarios that could happen where you could pull guard and do whatever you wanted because points didn't count. And we drill when you couldn't really pull guard because you'd give up a negative one. Right. Because you were going to end up in those situations and scenarios out there, and you need to be ready and prepared for them. So yeah, you know, probably for that reason, it does probably, you know, have a lot of a higher injury percentage training like that, especially when you're training hard and training with elite level guys like that. And of course, me, I give up like 30-40 pounds to or more to each of my teammates usually. So, you know, from time to time we'd bring other people in, but I'd say my ability to, you know, not get injured, especially when it comes to that area or whatnot, is probably due to the fact that I began wrestling when I was about between the ages of 4 and 5. Right. And the very first wrestling coach that I ever had, and it really opened my eyes to what wrestling was all about, was a man named Coach Kevin Hendricks, who is Johnny yes. Hendricks' father.
That's right.
And that's kind of where I started. And then, of course, I had a couple of different coaches throughout my elementary school career. Then I went on to wrestle in middle school and high school. And I actually did never wrestle in college. In middle school and high school, I wrestled for my wrestling coach. Yeah. Right now, named Annie Howington, and so. I actually did not go on to wrestle in college.
On ADCC, so you talked about the training camp. You said there was a weight cut involved. What did the 1 week leading up to ADCC look like for you in terms of training and diet? Was it rough?
You know, I will go ahead and say now, after the fact, that it was probably that final week was probably the most difficult I've ever had to endure. And it has to do with the fact that, you know, it's such a long travel to China. Of course, the previous two in Barcelona and Nottingham were, you know, pretty long, but not quite like this. This was a lot further away, and, you know, it was cold in China. You know, they also didn't, we weren't provided with an area to really, like, cut weight or that, you know, we could really, like, Like, there was no equipment at the hotel. There was no sauna. There wasn't anything close by, you know. So trying to get down, you know, a whole week out and maintain it was a very difficult job to do, especially considering that we didn't have any of that.
Did you have to run? Did you have to do the old school, put on the sweats and run?
I did the old school Vision Quest. I mean, I was out there the morning of weigh-ins in my plastic suit running up and down the streets of Beijing.
That's awesome, especially given the nice air I hear they have out there. How many days ahead of the tournament did you get out there?
Let's see. We left on Tuesday from here, and we arrived late Wednesday there. And so it left me with the rest of like a couple hours on Wednesday, and then all day Thursday and Friday morning before weigh-ins. And so, like, I didn't do anything Wednesday. Thursday, we found a kind of workout place or whatnot about 30 minutes away. And, you know, like, I you know, just kind of got shoved in a taxi and kind of took me there. And I had no idea where I was going when I got out of there. And it took me a while to actually find it. I'm amazed I even got back to my hotel. So,
well, were you alone in this taxi? I mean, did you just grab a cab yourself?
Yes, basically. I had one of the hotel clerks help me out. Yeah, I went there and I spent about 5 hours cutting weight and didn't do a great job out there. Like, you know, during that full 5 hours, I lost like 1.5 pounds. So that wasn't a good thing. I had a really hard time making it for whatever reason. But it was I woke up the morning of weigh-ins and I was still like a 1.2 pounds over, and so that's when I had to put the suit on and still go start running the streets of Beijing. And so that was, it was quite the interesting adventure, you know, there or whatnot.
Was it hard to stay positive through that? Was that wearing on you?
You know, it really was. It really was. It wasn't easy. There was a time there that I didn't even really think I was going to make it. And I was like, man, you know, how horrible would that be, like, to have gone through and done all this and then, you know, not make weight and get disqualified, especially the day before, because ADCC, you have to weigh in the day before, the day of, and then if you make it to the second day, you have to weigh in that day too. And not any one of those weigh-ins, they give you a pound allowance or kilogram allowance like they do in wrestling from day one to day two, which I think the ADCC honestly should consider doing.
Yeah.
Letting, you know, giving everyone, if it's equal across the board, you're not giving anyone an unfair advantage. I think that, you know, do well to, you know, maybe consider giving a kilo so that guys can, like, at least, you know, the ones that are close to weight, because you're always going to have athletes like that, you know, give them a chance to recover with something, you know. So, yeah, it certainly wasn't easy.
What was that second weigh-in like?
It was actually the easiest. It was the first weigh-in that first day that I really wasn't sure I was going to be able to make. Honestly, like, I still don't even really see a whole lot of reason behind that first weigh-in a whole day before when you have to make it the very next day anyway. And if it has to do, and I don't know what the reasoning behind it is, if it has to do with they just want to make sure their athletes are going to make weight, you know, I guess that's okay or whatnot. But to go ahead and disqualify them at that point in time, I think is somewhat unfair, especially when, you know, an organization like this can't even provide a place to cut weight for athletes who are close. You know, no matter where you draw the line for a certain weight class here and a certain weight class there, you're always going to have athletes who are close. And in an organization like that, I really think that, you know, to me it just sounds like, you know, common sense to have, you know, provided a place for us to do that. But
absolutely,
it didn't happen that way. And, you know, I in fact, the whole night before, I was really still unsure. I was like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to wake up and run after all the running and all the cutting weight that I did for 5 hours, and I only lost that much. I had a real hard time, you know, sweating and breaking a sweat out there as well for whatever reason. I'm not even entirely sure. You know, then of course I've got my roommate Jared Dopp sitting next to me, who's in the heaviest division, and he's sitting there in the bed. I'm sitting here like, oh my gosh, I don't know if I'm going to wake up and run this off, and he's sitting in the bed next to me drinking a gallon of water, going, oh man, this is going to be so awesome. It's his first time out there. Yeah. He's so excited to fight this guy and that guy and have a match with this guy, and he's just so ready to go. And I'm like, sitting over there like, man, I'm going to kill this guy if he takes one more sip of water in front of me.
It's not like you had a few three-minute matches. You had three wars that lasted the full distance. Did you feel the weight cut on the mat at all? Like, did you feel the cost of having made that cut, like the exhaustion, or did you have the energy? Or did you just toughen through it?
You know, I get asked this question a lot. Truthfully, honestly, no. Very few times has the weight cut ever really come back to bite me, especially cardio-wise. And I don't really have a good answer for why that is or how to explain that other than I've been doing that for a very long time. When I was about seventh grade, I started wrestling for the middle school wrestling team. I started cutting about 15 to 20 pounds every year to start making weight. So maybe just because I've been doing it for so long, you know, honestly, after that first weigh-in, I mean, it is like the best feeling in the world. It is like a huge weight lifted off my shoulders. Like, honestly, making the weight sometimes is the biggest opponent than even like trying to even mentally and visually get ready and prepared for my matches. And, you know, I think it's just something that I just try to tell myself, this is just part of the game. I'm going to push through it. You know, I know everyone else is just as miserable, and I'm not going to let it show on my face. And, you know, sometimes you can see it on other athletes' faces, like the weight cut, man, it's really not something they're used to. Maybe it's something they've done, you know, for the first time and they don't like it. And they're, you know, but my wrestling coach used to say it like this, you know, you can see it in their eyes. They're feeling sad and sorry for themselves and whatnot, you know, and it's going to go out there and it's going to affect their performance because they're feeling that way. They're telling themselves that mentally. And so if you just tell yourself, you know, like, and when you see that, like for me, when I see that, that makes me stronger immediately.
Right.
Okay? Just in my mindset. And I don't feel, you know, like the pain that I was feeling, you know, like when I was trying to make the weight or whatnot, you know. So for me, stepping on and off that scale is like the biggest relief and weight lifted off my shoulders in the world.
Yeah, it's a big victory. And in some ways, I think it takes your...
Making
the cut takes your mind off of the tournament. So it's almost like it's positive in that sense that you're not stressing out about the matches. You're kind of focused on this one goal of making the weight very practically. So that's kind of nice.
Yeah. I absolutely agree with you there.
In broad strokes, can you give some of us some advice on cutting weight for like IBJJF tournaments or something like that? Like, how do you change your diet? Like 2 weeks out, 1 week out, 1 day out?
Yeah, absolutely. I can kind of walk you through what I do. You know, when I'm about 8 weeks out from a tournament that I know I'm going to compete in and have to make weight, about 8 weeks, 6 to 8 weeks, sometime in there, whatnot. Between like 6 and 8 weeks, I slowly start to just cut back what I'm doing, and I you know, start like eating more clean and really starting to make the changes there. Like, I eat pretty clean for the most part anyway, but you know, I try to stay as fresh and as raw as possible. Right. when I start to do that. And then so like between 4 and 6 weeks, I'll start to cut back once again even more, so that way I'm starting to only take in maybe about half of what I was taking in when I started. And then I'll kind of stick to that for a while and kind of just watch and see how, you know, what my body feels over the next couple of weeks. And then the next time that I'll really start to worry about it again is about a week out. And, you know, like especially that. So 2 weeks out, you know, I'll check and I'll work really hard once again, because I like to try to make the weight a week out.
Right.
That way my body has been down to whatever weight I need to be, and it's felt it at least once. You know, obviously I can't maintain that for a whole week, but my body has kind of felt it, and I think that's kind of always helped my cardio. I got really close this time with ADCC. Like, I got down to about 148 pounds the week out, so it was pretty close. Wasn't exactly 145, but it was pretty close. So I've always believed that has helped me. And then, you know, of course, trying to maintain it as best I can the week around. Or the very next coming week has always been very helpful. And I'll make a really hard cut, probably about, especially like those last 3 or 4 pounds, if I need to, I'll make that last hard water weight cut about 1 to 2 days out.
On today's album, do you do something like the week before, cut or 2 weeks before, like you said, you cut down on carbs or something like that, or do you just cut down just on strictly on calories?
You know, and I've gone through and I've played with a lot of different things and a lot of different theories or whatnot. Like, in fact, that's what I actually got my master's degree in, was dietetics, and I was interested in it for that reason. Unfortunately, most of what I covered in my schooling was less, almost no sport aspect at all whatsoever, which was disappointing, especially for me. But I do a lot of my own reading, and in 2010, I went on this real big Omega Zone diet kick, and I was like, oh, I eat in these strict amounts, and I only take in this many and this many, and I would measure out And still to this day, one of my favorite breakfasts in the world. I don't do it quite as often as I used to. I used to do it every day. I would eat exactly two cups of blueberries with 28 grams of whey isolate protein, chocolate flavored. I'd blend that together with 8 ice cubes. I would eat 8 almonds and 4 grams of fish oil every morning.
So 8 almonds, you said? That's awesome. 8. You counted them out?
Yes, counted them out. Awesome. Yes, I was that particular and precise about it. Then I started reading a lot more about, timing and this and that, and when you need to be taking in certain nutrients. So now I follow more of I don't necessarily eat in certain amounts. I don't count calories nor carbohydrates. I start trying to just cut back how much I'm taking in about each meal, and that will naturally cut down everything. And when I do that, I will try to eat or not really necessarily eat, but I'll start to have put a little more protein into my diet. So I'll use a chocolate whey or something like that, and maybe just half of a serving or whatnot of that, just to make sure I'm still getting enough protein, trying to keep up muscle integrity and all that kind of stuff. But I'll slowly and naturally start to cut back what I'm eating now. And I eat more, the only time that I eat high glycemic carbohydrates are after workouts. And it's usually within 30 minutes after a workout, and then the rest of the day I'll eat I stick to fruits and vegetables when it comes to carbohydrates. I don't eat any breads at all whatsoever, no pasta, zero, none, especially with when I'm in training camp trying to make a cut of 25 something pounds or whatever. Right. It was. I think it was 23 for ADCC. So when I'm doing that, I absolutely won't eat any of that kind of stuff at all. And I just try to eat good, raw, fresh, healthy foods. And I try to do it like that. And I keep all the high glycemic stuff for usually after I work out or whatnot, when the time is right to kind of take that kind of stuff in. And I've seen a lot of improvements and gains in that way as well. So me personally, I don't necessarily follow any one diet or do this one particular thing or that particular thing. I'll eat enough to the point that I feel I'm fully recovered. And from then on, I won't. And then I'll start trying to cut back a little bit and go from there. But I don't, necessarily count or look at things so precise anymore. I go more by what my body feels. And I feel better that way in training camps as well. I feel my body at times, if you start to get too particular about it, your body is going to fight and resist you more. Right. Whereas it'll kind of do more what you say, kind of allow it the nutrients it needs at certain times. So yeah, I probably follow more of a Omega Zone / carb backloading theory. Kind of a lot of things intertwined between those two is probably what I would say I follow closest now.
Yeah, in a certain sense, while you got your master's in
dietetics.
Dietetics, yeah. You almost kind of got a PhD in dieting and healthy eating by just living it, and experimenting. So, but they don't give certificates for that, I guess.
Nope, unfortunately not.
So a quick step back to ADCC. It was in China, like you said, and it was sort of this suboptimal situation. But a lot of jiu-jitsu guys have experience with IBJJF tournaments, but very few have experience with ADCC. Can you, in general, how are the two organizations different? Is it very similar? Do you know when your fight is coming up? Is it well organized?
In that sense and regard, yes, they do a really good job of organizing it, running it. You have a really good idea of when you're going to go, when you're going to, you know, or when you're going to have to be ready and all that kind of thing or whatnot. I would say they do a great job. The biggest differences between the two is probably when it comes to a rule set, and that seems to be the biggest thing when you talk about just about any tournament in this sport and art. So the biggest differences other than like, you know, ADCC probably travels quite a bit more and is held every 2 years as opposed to having like a lot of, especially the Nogi ADCC anyway, is held every 2 years. So, you know, it differs in that way as well. But the biggest difference between the two is going to be the rule set.
Yeah, and the rule set at least somewhat attempts to encourage wrestling at least a little bit more than IBJJF tournaments. And so your first match against Augusto Mendez, he's a 2013 world champ in the gi. He beat Rafa Mendez in the finals. He's an excellent competitor, and you were able to beat him in your first match. That was a huge win, I think.
Probably the biggest win of my career.
Yeah. How did you feel going into that match? Were you confident? Have you faced him before? He's also a little bit heavier guy, right? He's usually fought lightweight. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Tanquinho is someone that I've been watching for quite a long time, that I respect a lot. He was in 2012, he won the Nogi Lightweight World Championships. And then in 2013, he was able to win in the gi at the Featherweight World Championships as well. And he had a really big day for himself that day as well. He beat Cobrinha in the semifinals, and then beat Rafael Mendez in the finals. So, you know, when you look at the brackets and everything, like I don't know how the brackets are made or whatnot. You know, I read a lot of posts on Facebook the night before, right after the brackets came out, and there was a lot of questions about whether that was really a first-round matchup or not. You know, he had competed at the ABCC before, under 77-kilogram division. You know, but honestly, I really didn't let it bother me. You know, like these are the very best of the very best. You knew you were going to be competing against these guys sooner or later. Might as well be sooner is kind of how I went into it. And I kind of went into it with, you know, and that was kind of what my training camp was like for this ADCC, being my third time and not really having performed, you know, gotten to the rounds that I wanted to the first couple times. I kind of went in with a bit of a chip on my shoulder. Yeah. Coming into this, I really wanted to do well. I had it in my mind that I was going to do well, and I go in with the same mindset every time, and that's I'm going to fight as hard as I can, as long as I can. I don't care who is standing across from me. You could be, you know, I don't care what you've done, who you've beaten, what you've accomplished, what everyone says about you. You know, to me, at the end of the day, you're a man standing right across from me. And that's something I just started asking myself. Like, it's so hard when you start talking about mindset and that kind of thing, because it's so simple, yet it just takes like the difficult part is it just takes time to get, you know. You can sit here and say this all day long, but to really understand it and live it is a whole other thing entirely, especially in moments like that where it's one-on-one, you and the other person out there, and you both lay it all down on the line. And so, you know, that's kind of how it was for me going into it. I didn't really, you know, look at it too much or read into it too much or think about it too much. It was like, I'm going to go out here. This is a tough competitor. I'm going to have to be, you know, certainly on my A game right from the get-go for sure. And I just tried to stay solid. I didn't let anything rattle me. And I really just, you know, played to my pace and style. And I play my game, especially in these situations. I don't go out there and think about, oh, my gosh, he's done this or that, or he's going to do this or he's going to do that, or I need to be ready for this or I need to be ready for that for him. My wrestling coach didn't teach me to be that way. I go out there and worry about me and worry about what I'm going to do. And I'm going to go out there and set the tone and the pace from the very beginning. I'm going to keep the match where I want to keep it. I'm not going to, you know, worry about what he might do. I'm going to worry about what I'm going to do. That's me. That's my style. I try to stay in there, really wear and grind on people. And I think that's really what was able to be the overcoming factor in that match, because we went all 20 minutes.
Yeah, it was a 20-minute match. You pushed the pace the whole time and shot. You kept shooting. You had a few awesome shots in the single, and actually, I think that's one of your favorite shots is the single. And I had you had a few beautiful shots on him, but I do have a question about that. Whenever I watch matches against Aquino, you know, like JT Torres had the same problem. He would shoot in. He's also a good wrestler. He would shoot in for the single and penetrate well, but had trouble finishing the single. I think you had the same problem in this match, but you just kept at it.
Do you
think there's something unique to jiu-jitsu that makes the single harder to finish?
Absolutely. One is guillotine attacks for sure. You know, there's a lot more things you got to pay attention to in there. Kimuras as well. There's a lot more submission attacks, like in straight, like, you know, collegiate style wrestling. You don't have to worry about any of that. Also, setting the person down, like, you know, and kind of settling in a wrestling match. Well, if I set someone down in jiu-jitsu, you know, they're immediately going to their guard. I've got to watch out, especially guys in my division. I've got to watch out for them inverting, trying to get underneath me, trying to set them down. I'm at an intermediate kind of space level, as I like to refer to it, so I can start my guard passing from my feet. But also the ADCC, it makes it a lot more difficult in the sense of the fact that just because you've taken someone down a turtle does not necessarily, you don't get points for that in the ADCC. You actually have to place their back flat on the mat and hold it there for 3 seconds. So that's where, especially trying to finish my takedowns on Tanquinho, I got him down a couple of times, actually two turtle, and I just wasn't able to flatten him out completely. And therefore, I was awarded no points. And I had one good, real good attempt. I spun around, I got one hook in, and almost got to the back. But he was able to roll and recover and get to his guard. And he did an excellent job there and was able to avoid the points.
Why was that avoiding the points? I did see you snapped him down into turtle and you spun around. And then he went to guard. Why is that no points? Can you explain that to me?
In the ADCC, as long as you have battled or fought there on your knees for 3 seconds, you're able to pull guard without picking up that negative one.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
And so he played the strategy great. He kept me from scoring any points the whole time. And like I said, at the end of the day, that's why I think my aggressive pace and really controlling the center of the mat, really, you know, and constantly, you know, staying in there, trying to pass his guard side to side, a lot of motion. I really think that's what was able to get me the victory at the end of the day that time.
And I think, you talk about mindset, and your next match was against Ruben Cabrinha Charles. He's a four-time world champion. He's a four-time no-gi world champion. He's an ADCC champion this year. And he's a three-time ADCC medalist. So I know you have a lot of respect for Cabrinha, and you guys, you know, as a fellow competitor, I think you guys are friends. Is it tough to face someone you respect so much? Do you think there were matches? So you faced him several times before. Do you think there were matches that you didn't go as aggressive and mean as you could have because of who he was?
Yes. The only time that I ever really felt that I did that was the first time I competed against him in 2008. This is my fourth time to compete against him. And all the other matches, I don't feel that was the case at all. I was able to put all of that, you know, out of my mind and aside. I've been watching Cabrini ever since I was a blue belt, and I've always looked up to the guy. And he's had an amazing career, one of the greatest featherweights ever. No one will ever be able to take that away from him. And you know, he's competed against a lot of bigger guys too. He's challenged himself in every way, and in my opinion, he's got absolutely nothing left to prove as far as being a competitor goes and being one of the best ever. So someone that I just look up to and respect so much. I learn so much each time I have a match against him. It makes me better each and every single time. But the only time, like the first match that I had against him, I was also a brown belt too.
That's right.
In 2008. And, you know, I was like, wow, I'm, you know, stepping on the mats across from Cabrinha. And I think the whole first half of that match, it was one of those times where, like, you know, I think I kind of gave him the respect in that regard, and I think I kind of held back a little bit. And I'm not by any means saying I would have won that day if I hadn't either. Cabrinha is an amazing competitor, but the next three times, I don't believe that was the case at all. And, you know, I gave him everything I had in the two World Championship Finals matches, in the IBJJF that we had. and he was the better man on both those days. And this past time at the ADCC, once again, a 10-minute match. Honestly, I think it's my was my best performance against him yet. I came up just a little short. He was able to stabilize his sweep, but I can't remember exactly, right around 8 minutes or so. Yes. There's only a couple minutes left in the mat. I've got to give him all the respect in the world. He was the better man that day. He deserved it, but it was probably my best performance against him.
I would have to agree. I mean, if I look at the way you approach that match, Cabrini has voted, I think I saw somewhere he has voted the best guard of the decade. She has an incredible De La Riva, reverse De La Riva guard, and he was attacking you. The way you approached him, you didn't seem to, you were like relaxed and letting him get under you. You didn't seem bothered by it. Is that something you work in training, like that ability to surf the guard like that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I don't have too much of a problem doing that kind of thing either or whatnot, because a lot of times what I'm doing there is I'm really trying to force someone to come up and single leg me, because I feel very confident in my single leg defense and my ability to wrap the head and get head control, front headlocks, guillotines, or whatnot. It's one of the favorite parts of my game.
Right.
So especially in the no-gi, where it comes to like using the De La Riva on the outside, looking to maybe even try to barambolo, or you know, trying to come up through on the inside or whatnot, trying to come out towards my back, I try to do a pretty good job of staying relaxed and comfortable and confident in there, in the sense of the fact that, one, it's no-gi, it's kind of slippery. A lot of times I can pretty easily kick my leg out, turn, face them again or whatnot. And I really do try to, you know, as much as I'm working my own passing or whatnot, guys that are so good at doing that, I really try to bait them to come up for the single leg a lot and try to look for attacks that way. The rest of that is really just kind of me using base and keeping my balance. And I do it as much as I can in training. We don't have necessarily, like, especially some of these guys, especially when you talk about Mendez, Cabrini, even Miao, who's got a crazy guard as well. It's hard to find guys to simulate their game as much as possible. And I do that to the very best of my ability. And one of the things that I did better in this training camp, more than any other training camp that I've ever been through, was I did a much better job of drilling and staying moving. Oftentimes, especially being a wrestler, like, I like just going live, and sometimes that can be detrimental. So I did a much better job of you know, pulling partners aside, and I really picked up a really good drilling partner throughout this past training camp as well, that was always there. You know, one of the students comes very consistently. I was able to make a lot more use out of my time there and drilling. I just tried to stay moving, and I would drill a lot of that kind of stuff when people try to come underneath and invert, and what I was going to do, what I was going to look for. But I really feel pretty comfortable and confident when I'm in there.
Well, how do you like to do the drilling usually? Is it something, do you focus on the timing, or do you get the static reps? And how do you like to work your top, how do you like to drill your top game against some of these guards?
You know, I kind of, like you said, I'll drill some things for reps, like a lot of this. And sometimes I'll even break it down, too, in the little steps. Like when I see things here and I want to do this, and I'll drill that, you know, and then, okay, well, the next part of it is here. So then I'll start to build, you know, off little things like that. And then I'll just drill the moves, you know, over and over and over again. And then I do a lot of, like, timing drills, too, where, you know, like as I see them spinning this way, I'm kicking at this point at a certain time. And honestly, it's really just about getting out there, getting moving, and, you know, just you know, feeling, you know, the De La Riva come in, you know, especially like right at the beginning, like when I started doing a lot more drilling or whatnot, I had to like walk my training partner through, like, you know, a couple, okay, you got to invert, you know, kind of like this is the way it's going to be.
Right.
And honestly, it was very helpful in that way too, because it was almost like having to teach what they were going to do.
Right.
And it helped me understand it, you know, even better. And every time I go out there, like I said, and I face one of these top level competitors, you know, Cabrinha, Mendez, you know, it's always made me tenfold better the time when I come back again, you know. And obviously they, you know, they're training hard, taking their training seriously or whatnot, you know, and everything like that, you know. So yeah, it's all about walking out there, testing myself, you know, against the best in the world, and seeing the progress that I've made.
Yeah, you had you also had the bronze match was against Joao Miao. This is one of another incredibly difficult guard to do anything with. So I saw you have a a video series on JustinRader.com that where you talked a little bit about how you approach some of these tricky guards from the top. Can you talk a little about that video series?
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, I just got done filming my first video series. We'll call it the hybrid success formula. Mm-hmm. And it's truly what I believe myself to be. Really taking this whole like meshing of wrestling takedowns with top pressure passing. And when I approach some of these guards, oftentimes, like I especially these real tricky guards, and guys in my division, they're so good at inverting and getting underneath you and coming out to your back. You know, it makes it really difficult to pressure pass and yes. just get in there and smash. And someone's going to stay in front of you and play in front of you, and you can just kind of grind your way in and look and work for the head and knee cross pass through, mount to side, or you know, whatever the case may be, or work your way over to a side smash kind of position or whatnot. Guys in my division are so flexible and so good at inverting and getting underneath there and beating people coming out, taking their backs, using the Baron Bolo, the outside Daily Heave or whatnot. Like, you know, to always go in and think you can just, you know, immediately like knee cross, apply pressure and pass really isn't the case. And so I really showcase a lot of set of moves that I've tried to use and had, you know, a lot of success with over the years against some of the very best guards in the world. But I especially, you know, and I've had success doing both these in gi and no gi. But especially in the no gi, I kind of pass from what I call this intermediate distance, where I'm not necessarily forcing my way in, because you really can't against some of these guys. They turn and spin, and next thing you know, they're on your back, and you're like, I was pressuring in like I was always taught. What happened, you know? But obviously, you can't disengage and run away either, and always be backing up. So I try to keep everything at an intermediate distance, as I call it, where I'm engaged, but I'm not allowing them to I'm not smashing in or driving my way in, giving them the momentum and ability they need to invert or spin around and come out towards my backside. And so I talk a lot about controlling the ankles and really using the bullfight pass or Toriando pass or whatever you want to call it, especially a no-gi, to work for an advantageous angle first and then kind of work your way in from there. Because once you get the advantageous angle, you kind of you're maybe not a full step ahead, but you're about a half step ahead from whoever it is you're facing, because then they're having to react in some way to the movement you just made to kind of recover and get back in front before they can begin doing whatever it is else that they want to do. Obviously, guys are good. It doesn't always, you know, work out that way. You know, they're able to spin and get around underneath, and that's where, you know, some of the drilling for that and kicking out kind of comes in. But I try to stay at this intermediate distance where they can't really get underneath me.
And you control the how you engage it. Yeah, I recommend it highly to people, because I'm a medium-heavy guy, but some of the toughest, and I love my division, but some of the toughest matches I have are in the absolute against little guys. And I think I have the big problem, like you said, I'm a smash pass guy as well, and I rush in there a little bit too quickly and can pay for it. Because once you let a little guy go under you, it could be over pretty quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's nothing wrong with smash passing. Like, it's great. It works, you know. But there are some guys out there that you kind of need to know who they are. Especially being a bigger guy, like you're saying, going up against a little guy. Like, you know, if they get underneath you and they come out to your back, like, you know, especially some of these guys that are, you know, they got grips for just days. Like, they can go three matches of gripping, like, at their most intense strength and, you know, not even get tired. So it's like, oh, my gosh, you know, what am I going to do? So, yeah, I try to play from this intermediate distance. And I know how that looks, you know. And like I was saying earlier, I try to force and bait people a lot of times to come up and single leg me, because that's what I'm giving them, you know. And they choose not to do that. And I choose not to pressure pass into them. And sometimes, you know, in at some points during my match or whatnot, like, sometimes to me it's just funny to read some of the things people will post on YouTube behind screen names or whatever. They could say whatever they want to say, but you get a lot of comments like, oh, I was running away, or I didn't engage or whatnot. Well, it's not that I didn't engage. I was engaged. I was giving them, you know, the chance, you know, multiple opportunities to come up a single leg. Like, me, they didn't take any one of them because that brings. I'm keeping the game where I want to keep it, where I want it, where I want it to play.
Yeah, I've seen comments like that. I've seen blog posts of that kind, and it's funny to me, especially about your match against Joao Miao. When I first saw the match, I thought it was awesome. It was like beautiful dynamic jiu-jitsu, and it just, in my mind, you were shutting down Miao's guard, and you're playing on your terms and working for the pass. But in some people's minds, I think the fact that you were shutting his guard down, I think it they were, you know, saying that you're somehow like stalling, or you're yes. you're like running away. And to me, it's yeah. like no, that's not the. When you're a top guy, Joao Miao's guard is one of the most impossible guards to pass, especially it's extremely difficult to pass. So you were working it very hard to try to pass it and shutting down his attempts. So I don't want to see. I think that's the most beautiful jiu-jitsu, actually, to watch.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, you know, because I think it's just a misconception. Like, if I was truly running away based on the rule set of the tournament that is in place, if I was truly running away, I'd have been warned, I'd have been given a negative, I'd have been disqualified.
Yeah, be penalized.
Yeah, I'd have been penalized, eventually to be disqualified, if that was truly the case. But it wasn't. And that's the thing, like it, you know, especially as a passer, and that being my main A game, and I go in there and I you know, set the tone and the pace, and I like the, having the takedowns has always you know, kind of in my back pocket, you know, kind of always allowed me to let the match go where I want it to go. If I want to keep it standing, or if I want to be on top, then I'm going to be there and I'm going to battle for that, because it's my A game. That's what I do best at, and so I'm going to keep it there. And so, you know, I give a lot, I give a lot of opportunities for people to try to come up. They could easily sit up from the guard, try to single leg me. And, you know, oftentimes it just doesn't happen. And I understand that, like, you know, it's not their A game. I'm forcing them to try to take a chance to come, you know, and play on only my terms while not running away or not disengaging. And yes, truthfully, against Joao Miao, that was absolutely the game plan, was to go in there and shut his guard down and maybe try to force him into making a mistake, coming up, maybe trying to single leg me, or just frustrating him enough that I could maybe roll through, get his head, you know, and yeah. he had opportunities. He was able to come out to my back once.
Yes, and you escaped.
I was able to shake him off. You know, he did almost when he almost swept me another time. Like I was kind of on my butt, and we had to start back in the middle, but he wasn't able to hold me down long enough for any points. So he had a couple opportunities. I had a couple opportunities myself. I dove through his guard a couple of times. I had his head pretty good. Couldn't quite get my legs free to work for a pass. So, you know, all in all, and then of course the ABCC, you know, in after the first half of the match, they penalized for pulling guard, and he bet on his guard game the entire time, and you know, picked up a couple negatives. And so, you know, especially once I was up by a couple negatives, well then, you know, like you know, the pressure was on him to try to come up, single leg, or do all he could, and he made a few attempts at the end of the match to try to do that, and that's truly where I wanted to keep it the entire time. And so to me, it was a strategy played perfectly.
Yeah, I've seen, so Miao got on your back for a brief second there. I've seen Cabrini on your back. I've seen people on your back. You escape these sort of dominant positions very well, especially in your weight class. There's some of the best back takers in the world. Do you work on escaping the back take a lot in training?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, always in training, we always drill and train from different positions. We have a lot of specific positional sparring that we'll do with guys starting on our back, with maybe just the over-under lock, starting with one hook, starting with both hooks. And those aren't always the most enjoyable drills to do, but they're absolutely yeah. necessary. You get caught a lot of times. Now you've already been in practice for two and a half hours, and now we're doing specific positional sparring for like 20 minutes now. And like, man, you know, like we got fresh guys coming in on us, and like, yeah, you get, you know, yeah, you're gonna get caught from time to time. There's nothing you can do about that. Like, you know, but drilling, especially when you're tired and broke down like that, in the worst possible case scenarios, like having, you know, someone on your back is very important. We do a lot of that kind of training. I'm sure all of the athletes do. It's truly not to, never part of the game plan. You never draw it up like that. I think sometimes, even still, I did it a lot much more earlier on in my career, probably because of my wrestling background that came first. But I used to have a big problem giving my back up too much because I didn't want to be on my back. And by about, you know, through Purple Brown and especially now at Black Belt, like, I don't have those tendencies too much anymore. From time to time, it still probably comes out. But I actually do feel a lot more comfortable on my back, playing from my back. I actually have, in training, probably the guys in training are probably about the only guys that ever get to see it. But, I've got a decent guard game that I just don't ever necessarily use because I don't find myself in that situation too much. Like I said, my A game is taking people down, grinding them out there, pressure passing, grinding them out there. You know, if I need to stay at this intermediate distance, trying to avoid all the upside down inverted stuff, looking for stack passes, looking for chances to jump through their guard, catch their head in a rollover guillotine pass, then that's what I'm going to do. You know, so yeah, you know, like I've got a lot of good guard things that I do. It's just not something I put on display all the time in competition. But, you know, absolutely, we start in all those positions and training or whatnot. And I probably don't give up my back as much as I used to because I do understand and have a better guard game than I've ever had in my career right now. So it probably has helped a lot in that way. It's probably just not put on display very much.
Going back a little bit, where were you born? In Oklahoma?
I was actually born in Columbia, Missouri.
How did you get to Oklahoma?
My dad was doing his residency out in Columbia, Missouri. And then once his residency was finished, I was about a year, maybe almost 2 years old, when we moved back to Oklahoma City.
Okay, cool. So you're almost completely Oklahoma raised.
Pretty much, yeah.
So what is it about, so if people don't know, Oklahoma and Iowa are like, there must be something in the water because the culture there, produces some of the best American wrestlers. Why do you think that is? Is it part of the culture?
I think so. And I think when you've got like, guys that were born here and came from here and went on to do great things, like John Smith, who have come back to coach and is the head wrestling coach out at the Oklahoma State University out here, obviously guys are going to be attracted to that and want to come and train there. You mentioned Iowa and Tom Brands, and of course, guys are going to want to go out there. Same thing in Pennsylvania when Cale Sanderson moved out there and is the head coach out in Pennsylvania now. I mean, obviously, guys are going to want to go train under guys that most everyone probably shares like the same dream, you know, going through, getting that Olympic gold medal, just like many of those guys, being an NCAA Division I national champion. And if you want to be the best, you have to go, go out there, test yourself against the best, beat the best, and train and learn from the best or the best that you can find. So those guys are obviously going, to attract top high-level wrestlers. And so it kind of becomes tradition at some point, too. Like, it's something that, like Oklahoma State has always had very elite wrestling program, and so it kind of trickles on down through, So we got a lot of wrestling fans out here. You know, people get their kids involved early and at a young age. My dad is the one that got me started.
That's right.
And he thought it was very important to not necessarily. My dad never got me started in wrestling or martial arts for the competition aspect. He wanted it only for, if I ever had to defend myself or be in that situation, I'd be well equipped. And two, everything else that it has to offer, all of the virtues, it teaches you humility, discipline, dedication, perseverance, all the virtues that come with martial arts and wrestling in order to be good, at it and whatnot, and it was very helpful in all of those ways from early on, so my dad sought out the most competitive and most accredited coach that he could, and in the area where we were at Oklahoma City and Edmond, that just happened to be Kevin Hendricks, Johnny Hendricks' father, and that's where I ended up. And out at the University of Central Oklahoma was where we actually at their college, in their college wrestling room. That's where we held our elementary school practices Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday of every week.
What did those practices look like? Leading into a conversation about your coaching JR Warriors now. You're coaching little guys yourself or young guys. So looking back at when you were just wrestling under Kevin Hendricks, what were those training sessions like? Do you remember?
Oh, I've got quite a few vivid memories because it was a complete culture shock for me. I started to kind of get involved in activities and athletics, but right around the ages of like 3 and 4, well, about 3 and a half, kind of about 3 and a half to 4 and a half, you know, I did some gymnastics as well. And
awesome.
Then it kind of moved into wrestling when I started to get older enough, well, close to like 4 and a half, 5 years old, when I kind of started getting involved in wrestling. And, you know, it was a complete culture shock for me. Obviously, I'm very young. I'd never been pushed quite like that before. I mean, you know, to start off, you know, like getting in there, getting right after it, jogging, warming up, stretching, right into hard drilling. I mean, like they'd go over, you know, like some technique or whatnot, and then it'd be drilling and drilling and drilling. We'd drill for quite a while, and then, man, we like even day one, boom, already live wrestling. You know, it's of course me. It's my first year. There's plenty of other first year kids in there, first day kids in there, for that matter. You know, but you're also in a room. You know, especially in elementary school room, you're in there with kids that have been wrestling 2, 3, 4 years. And to me, I had no idea, like, of anybody in the room. I was I'm not an aggressive, competitive person by nature. I'm actually a very shy, reserved, conservative right. type of person. And that was the other thing that, you know, my dad wanted to get me involved in stuff like that, because I wasn't very outgoing
right.
as a kid. I wasn't very talkative. I wouldn't initiate conversation. I've always had trouble making friends in that regard. And so martial arts and wrestling for that reason has helped me out a lot too. But I mean, I wasn't aggressive, you know, by nature at all. And then, like, you know, to have guys that had experience and be in there, like, and I didn't know many of the other kids in there. You know, many of them were some of the top guys in the state in their respective weight classes already as elementary school wrestlers, being part of that program. And of course, Johnny was in there, and, you know, man, he was just awesome, and he was quite a bit older than me, and quite a bit bigger. So I never actually like wrestled with him like personally myself. But, you know, being in that room with so many tough guys, like, I just got the holy life beat out of me. and it kind of traumatized me. Like right from the get go, I thought I wasn't very good. I didn't, I went in there and at that point in time, I didn't even really understand why my dad wanted me there. I didn't enjoy it. It was hard. And, I didn't want to let my dad down or, you know, ever disappoint him, you know, oh, I hate going or whatnot. But there was quite a number of years where, I didn't like going. I was always the nail. But eventually, over time, of course, you start to pick things up or whatnot. I actually got to a point where I felt comfortable in the environment I was in the room, and I became a really good room wrestler. But like, and the other thing too, I never got to like go watch a competition. It was like, oh, competition is this weekend. All right, let's go do it or whatnot. I'm like, okay, I had no idea what I was getting into, and it scared the life out of me. It was very traumatic, and
yeah.
You know, it took me probably a good 10 years. To get over that. And it wasn't anything, it wasn't like I was bad or I had bad technique or anything. It was a complete mental block from the very beginning. I walked out there crying, didn't want to be there in my first like wrestling match ever. I walked out on the mat crying. I wrestled through the entire match crying. I pinned the kid, raised my hand. I'm still crying.
Still crying.
I went off the mat more scared than any, like, I don't even really remember much of the match. I know that's what happened, but I don't remember much of it, to be truthfully honest, either. Like, I was scared out of my life. I ran off. I wanted to get out of there. Everyone watching me, this kid coming after me, hitting my head, trying to take me down and hurt me or whatnot. You know, I wanted out of there, you know? So it was very traumatic. So I kept going on through. And I mean, I throughout my – and I tell my junior warriors that I teach out here this, you know, if I added up the losses of everything, of every sport you guys have ever done – you know, added them all up, and that's all 55 of you that I've got on the match right now or whatnot, it wouldn't even begin to come close.
That's awesome. So you lost a lot of matches when you're first starting out.
I was the nail for a good 10 years.
How did you deal with loss then? I mean, maybe after like a full day that you competed and you haven't won a single match, how do you go home and go on to train the next day, motivated still to work hard?
A lot of times I didn't. I always wanted to put too much pressure on myself to perform as well. And that, you know, coupled with the fact that I didn't even really like, care, want to be there a lot of times. You know, I felt like I was letting everyone down and everything. You know, I think every athlete goes through that, you know, at some point or another.
Absolutely.
You know, in their time or whatnot. I think for me, with as sensitive as a person as I was back then, that I just let it get to me on a level that I just could never shake. And to a point that it almost just became routine. Like, I would go because, like, for some reason, to me, it was important. I knew it was important to my dad, so I went. It almost just became like I would go, lose, and, you know, we just keep on going through in life or whatnot. I, like I said, I didn't even still really fully understand why I was doing that at such a, especially when I didn't enjoy it.
Right. What would you say was the turning point? Because, I mean, you were runner-up in state your senior year, and this is a very tough state to do that in wrestling. So what was the turning point, would you say, when you just – when you started to love wrestling?
Well, I would say the turning point was living in Edmond in Oklahoma City or whatnot, going to Edmond schools. By the time we all went to middle school, there were a couple different middle schools. Like most of the kids that I wrestled with in elementary school, we were one, more or less one program. And a lot of us went on to wrestle at different middle schools. Some went to a school out here we have called Edmond North. Some went to a high school. That was our middle school, high school called Edmond Memorial. That's where Johnny Hendricks actually went and wrestled for and won 3 state titles for, I believe. I went out to a place called Deer Creek, Edmond, and it was a much smaller class. I was finally in, like for me going out there at that point in time, I had like 8 years of wrestling experience by this point. And, you know, wrestling, being on the team out there and wrestling for them or whatnot, I was, you know, like I finally got to see, one, like how good I actually was. To me, going in there in the room with all these kids, like for a long time, it never really clicked. Like, you know, I mean, I would hear they were state champions or this or that or whatnot, you know, but like, I just thought I was very, I just thought I sucked because they just beat the holy life out of me, like every practice or whatnot, you know. But then I got to finally be in a room with kids. It was like their first year, second year, third year. By this time, I've already been wrestling like with some of the very best guys in the state already for like 8 years or whatnot. Like I was like immediately the very best kid in the wrestling room, and I was like, oh, that's kind of cool, you know. But still, the whole competition aspect was a whole other thing entirely that was so traumatic from the beginning that I still had to work through. So it started off gradually. Like I finally started to realize, like, hey, I'm a lot better than I ever gave myself credit for, and you know, so that was very helpful in and of itself. But when I started wrestling for my wrestling coach, Andy Howington, he was the one that I think truly, like, from a lot sooner point than I ever did, saw the potential that I had and really believed in me. And it worked so hard for so many years to the point, like, I think it just drove him crazy sometimes that the lack of confidence in belief in my own ability that I would have, I think it just drove him insane sometimes. Because I wrestled for him in 7th, 8th, and 9th grade, and then When I went into my freshman year, he was the middle school head coach for 7th and 8th grade. And when I went into my freshman year in high school, he took over the high school.
Oh, cool. So he followed you all the way through. Cool.
Got to wrestle with him all the way through, all throughout 7 years. And so that was awesome and truly very helpful because the more times we went out there and did it, it was a process. Like I would go out there and I started off very inconsistent. I'd have a good match here and there, but for the most part, still didn't really believe, like, you know, I never saw myself being a state champion or anything like that. I never thought that was in the cards for me. And he was the one that finally got me to, it was basically like, why not? You know, I mean, I know how simple that question sounds, but at the same time, it's very difficult to eventually comprehend and was for me. You know, yeah, you can break it and say simple, why not? Why not you? Okay, why not? Well, I don't really know. There is no reason why not. Of course there is no reason why not. It's yep. Really is that simple. It's just hard to eventually comprehend and believe.
Yeah, it's important, right, for a coach to believe in you.
Right, and he helped me see that belief in myself that I have now. It was about my sophomore year in high school that he was finally getting through to me. I was starting to become more consistent. I started winning matches. My eighth grade year in junior high, I mean, I finished great. Like all the big matches, you know, the 3 big matches I had that year, I mean, I lost them all. But, I mean, I finished with like a 30-3 record or whatnot, which I thought was like, for me, I was like, wow, I couldn't believe I even did that. And then so by continuing to work through that process or whatnot, you know, him always – know, being on me, you know, like you know, you just got to believe in yourself and really, you know, working through and molding my mindset in that way that they're like I am that good. You know, I just have to believe it. My sophomore year, I went out in the first tournament of the year and I beat a state qualifier from the year prior or whatnot. And then that was a pretty big step for me, especially in the high school scene. And then 2 weeks later, I turned around and I beat the number one ranked kid in the class above me, which was 4A at that time. And that was one of the times that it really, like, that was one of the defining moments of my life. And I relapsed once or twice from that. But by about the time about to my senior year, I really didn't have too many problems with that anymore, not believing in myself and just not worrying or caring about what anybody else there off the mat or at school or anywhere had to say. Like, I was going to go out there and do what I do. And then I finally started believing what my wrestling coaches always say, which is you go out there and give your best effort and you never quit. You never just roll over or whatnot. If we lose that day to someone better, we don't really accept that, but we'll learn from it and we'll come back better next time. And I really started believing that. And like, and still to this day, like when I walk off the mat, especially after a loss, there's only one person I want to hear from. And that's whoever's coaching me, whether, you know, at that point in time, it was him, at this point in time, you know, but the only person I'd really ever want to hear from is Professor Rafael Labate.
So what after a tough loss, say your two Nogi World Championship finals against Cabrinha, what do you want to hear from Professor Rafael Labate Jr. after that loss? Like, what do you want, to just quietly look at you in disappointment or,
no.
What do you think is the role of a coach in that situation?
Especially after that first one, he wasn't disappointed in me at all. He told me that, you know, like, because I remember being in the stands right after that, and he was like, you know what, you went out there and fought your heart out, you put it all on the line, you know, no one can ask more of you from what you did and your performance out there, you know, like, it just didn't go our way today or whatnot, and kind of just left it at that, you know, told me he was very proud of me. And you know, I mean, yeah, I mean, no, I don't like losing by any means. I absolutely hate it. To me, it speaks volumes about the belief that he has in me. And for me, right, that's incredibly important, especially when it comes to my mindset of walking out there prior to the match.
And
I've got like my small close circle is in full support, you know, of me, and that's all like right or whatnot. Like that to me is the only thing that's important to me. And if I have that, I'm going to be one very difficult opponent for anybody. And that's the kind of mindset that I try to walk in with.
Right. You have a strong support group behind you, but you're a coach yourself now. What do you think is your role as a coach when your juniors compete? I think I've seen you both that, you know, they're looking to do some tournaments. They've done already well at some tournaments. What do you say to them after a tough loss?
Yeah, you know, I'm always very proud of them, and it's been a process getting this program to this point. But I'm super stoked with it. Like I love it. I love teaching those kids and whatnot, and I want to try to go through and like help them. The mindset is exactly the same as I've been talking about. I don't treat them too much differently from adults. I'm probably not quite as hard on them from time to time or whatnot. And we do. We try to like, and for me, it's fun. I get to have a lot more fun with them. So it's all good, you know. I don't treat them honestly too much differently of what I ask from them or expect from them than I might any adult that wants to become a great competitor as well. I talk to them constantly about what I expect from them. And do I expect from them, right, especially right now, so early and young, like winning and losing is not like the be-all, end-all at the end of the day, especially at this level with where they're at. You know, it's all about learning and experience. And then, of course, you know, while we're there, we have fun doing that.
Do you call them out if they're maybe not working as hard as they could be? Do you try to push them in that way? Like you were pushed when you were.
Yes, absolutely. But that's also very individually based.
Okay.
You know, and trying to determine this person, they've shown to be a great competitor. They know that's what they want. From time to time, I might even be a little bit, you know, harder with them, if you want to say harder.
Yeah.
I might be on it a little more to stay focused or that kind of thing or whatnot. You know, but I don't ever want to push someone past what they're willing to commit to it or whatnot, you know. And this brings up a very interesting point, and one that I've wrestled with and gone back and forth with a lot throughout my career, especially when I began teaching the kids, is can or should I even run a martial arts room or practice like a wrestling practice?
Right.
And honestly, I where I'm at right now, I really don't think I should. I think that's for those that have never wrestled, like especially some of the rooms that I competed in wrestling and trained at in wrestling. I mean, the wrestling environment is can truly be summed up in kill or be killed.
Right. There's it's more intense, more aggressive. It's almost mean sometimes, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's not uncommon for fights to break out in wrestling rooms.
Right.
Like, and coaches will even kind of let that kind of thing like go on a little bit. Like, yeah. I mean, not to the point that, you know, you're all out fist fighting each other, you know, like hurting each other, but you know, they'll let like little scuffles, like, you know, kind of go whatnot and like kind of be decided amongst, you know, whoever, whatnot. Like in a martial arts room and setting, I don't believe that's necessarily the right mindset to take. Because not everyone is in there to be a great competitor, you know. The other thing too is like, especially on a team at school, like it's a privilege to be there. The other thing you have to take into account is, you know, especially some of the kids in a martial arts room, like they are paying to be, you know, and then that, you know, whether you know you think that does or doesn't play a part in and is important at the end of the day, results or whatnot, it does. And it, you do have to take that into account.
Yeah, in a certain sense, you would. I mean, like you talked about, it's possible for a kid to come home crying because of how hard the training was in from a wrestling room.
Oh, of course.
And perhaps if it's if their parents see that kind of thing, it's hard to see your kid crying and see that as a good thing. It is a good thing. Well, at least I'm a wrestler, so I feel like wrestling has transformed me. I mean, in a similar way as you've talked about, you know, I wasn't as tough of a kid, and it made me in a tougher kid. But that's tough for a parent to see, you know, that process, I think.
Absolutely, and sometimes like maybe and that's why wrestling truly is not for everyone. And I mean, it's truly kill or be killed. You know, like only the strong survive. That kind of thing or whatnot. I mean, it's there to make you tough. And like when I joined the wrestling team at my middle school, it was explained to us, like they sat us all down in this big room and they talked about the sports. And these sports are competitive sports. In wrestling, you have one representative per weight and you battle it out amongst your own team for that. You have ranking matches. And yeah, there are kids that do not get to wrestle. There are kids that do not get to play, you know, and does that mean that they're not worth something to the team and the overall end goal, in my opinion? No, it doesn't mean that. But at the same time, and that's the other thing too, like especially some of these bigger tournaments in jiu-jitsu, like I wish there was only one representative from each team, you know? And I think it would go a long way in you know, evolving both the sport and the art for a lot of different reasons. You know, but yeah, I mean, wrestling, they almost like you go in there and they'll almost try to make you quit. You know, they're going to push you to that point or whatnot. In a martial arts room, especially it being a martial art, you know, and sometimes I go back and forth with whether I even consider wrestling a martial art. Right. You know, I think some aspects of it are. I think some aspects on the competition side perhaps aren't. And maybe within the own martial art itself, you have, you know, and sometimes I refer to it as a sport and art at the same time because I'm talking about two different aspects of jiu-jitsu as well.
Yeah. I mean, culturally, they're certainly very different. Like if you just symbolized by the simple fact, like if I watch your matches, for example, like the way you shake hands or even in training at the academy, and most people will shake hands, you know, fist bump, whatever. And the same thing at tournaments, you shake hands before the match and after the match, and there's often hugs seen, like a hug of respect after a jiu-jitsu match. In wrestling, at least in my experience, I haven't seen a single hug.
It's certainly not quite as common. It's fewer and further between. You know, especially if you watch like the NCAA D1 finals, most of them it's a real quick handshake, and that person is off. Yeah. Running out of the arena, whatnot. Yeah. I've seen plenty of those. You know, most of the time, I would say that sportsmanship is shown and pretty good, though. But yeah, culturally they're different or whatnot. And martial arts is a different culture. And so I've really taken a hard look at what I want to, especially when I started, what is it I want to create? And truly, honestly, teaching martial arts, that's how I see it first. I teach these kids martial arts first. Do I have a competition team? Yes. Do we have a time set aside for them to train once a week, especially for those kids? Yes, we do. Those kids want that. I'm willing to provide it if that's what they want. But that doesn't mean that, like, I'm going to, you know, blow off everyone else or whatnot, or I teach these other classes that we know. Those classes are still very important to me in the martial arts setting, because what I want to do through this art is reach as many people as I can, bring them in, build them up, you know, train them, and really make them all around better people, and instill in them virtues and values that they'll be able to take with them no matter what they decide to do in life and through any walk in life that they may have. You know, if they're going, you know, like boom, they approach a tougher time in their life in the years to come, and they're able to endure it because of something I taught them in class one day. And you'd be amazed. It could be something as small as like a little off to the side conversation that can have just a monumental impact. That's one of the things I've really seen through this program. That's one of the reasons, like when I first began teaching it almost 3 years ago, it wasn't really in the plan. In fact, when I went to Tina Lovato, Professor Raphael's wife, and said, like, you know, we didn't really know where we were going with the program. We're kind of struggling with who we were going to find to teach it or whatnot. I said, you know what, let me give it a shot. At the very least, like, if I'm not very good, you know, like it'll buy you at least a couple of months. Maybe we find someone better to put in its place. And I kind of just started doing it. Before I started doing it or whatnot, I believe first kind of reaction, because I had spoken many times, like it was something I never really wanted to do. I never thought I'd be good at it. She kind of laughed when I first said that too. Then I just kind of started doing it and
fell in love with it.
Never really stopped, you know, and just kind of, you know, started to get better. But to me, it was so rewarding and fulfilling or whatnot, you know, especially to you know, when a kid runs in and like the highlight of the day is like running into the academy and, you know, having them, you know, or seeing them or whatnot, you know, yelling out to them, you know, like giving them a high five or whatnot, you know, like and seeing just their faces bright up and that kind of thing is just so awesome. And they go in there and they have a great time. They're learning something useful. Yes, I do, you know, discipline obviously comes with the territory from time to time. But at the end of the day, they know that it makes them better. And, you know, we have a lot of, like, sit-down discussions at the end of class about, you know, like, certain things I expect. I talk to them and try to connect with them, too, through my own personal experience. Like I was talking about the winning and losing. And I said, every one of you guys, add up all the losses. I promise you, you don't even begin to scratch the iceberg of the nail that I was for 10 years.
That's really inspiring to see, you know, because you've lost a lot. And then to see where you've come, it probably takes the pressure off of them that they don't have to win so much in the beginning.
Oh, absolutely.
Can just go through that.
Absolutely. And you know what, like everyone, and that's the other thing too that I really try to stress to all, everyone has something to offer. Everyone, you know, whether like, if competition is for you, that's great. If you like coming in here and helping people learn moves or drill or cover their curriculum for a test, that's awesome. If you like helping new students that come in and like befriending them right from the get-go, like, you know, that's awesome or whatnot, you know, like and they're all learning the same things or whatnot, you know, like if their main goal is like for self-defense and confidence, that's awesome, you know, like yeah, I'm gonna take time, definitely help you there, you know, like whatever I can do. And I try to spend the way the program has grown, you know, especially over this past year, it's like, you know, more than doubled in size. You know, like I finally started to, like, I need to break the age divisions up again and create more classes so I can get back to more of the one-on-one attention.
Awesome.
That we're getting, because running a class of 55 presents its challenges, especially even when it comes to mat space too. But it's been an absolutely awesome experience. I love doing it. And I love goal setting with them, you know, like we've started small, you know, like, you know, going to tournaments, bringing bigger teams to tournaments or whatnot. Okay, now I've got enough kids. Like, now we're starting to, like, win team titles. And you know, like, we've got kids that'll come and watch and support and yell and cheer for the team. And, you know, so they're supporting in that way. You know, obviously we've got competitors. the parents have been a huge support system. They've been great, you know, so.
Yeah, competition brings people together. It's awesome. And maybe you guys have a world champ out of there sometime soon.
Hopefully. That'd be great.
So real quick, I don't know if you can tell me, but it's possible that you might be having an MMA debut in 2014, right? Is it possible? Well, okay, you don't have to answer that.
Very, very possible.
Okay, it's possible, right. So unlike jiu-jitsu, in MMA, you potentially get punched and kicked in the face. I hear that hurts quite a bit.
It does. You know, I will say I'll go ahead and tell you, I am planning to make my professional mixed martial arts debut in 2014. It was supposed to happen this year. I've been doing a lot of stand-up training. In fact, I took this whole year off of training in the gi, and I really took a step back and really devoted a lot more time to training my stand-up and striking, and it increased by leaps and bounds in that regard. I see myself as a beginner when it comes to MMA. There's so much that I have to learn, even when it comes to the ground and putting it together, because yes, punches changes a lot of things. And it's my true philosophy and theory behind the art of jiu-jitsu that I believe in, you know, and I'll explain that in a moment. But, you know, like I said, I consider myself a beginner in all aspects of it. You know, yeah, I've got, you know, decent jiu-jitsu. I've got decent wrestling. My striking was the one area that I thought needed a lot of work. It was supposed to happen. I was actually scheduled to be on an event September 28th, and that event got canceled and rescheduled for 1 week after ADCC. And that wasn't going to quite work for me very easily.
No.
I wanted to compete at the ADCC. 2 weeks later was the No-Gi Worlds. I didn't have anything planned or whatnot. So, you know, of course, Professor Raphael was competing, James Popolo was competing, Jared Dopp was competing, and I hadn't quite made up my mind, especially coming back from China, until about, you know, 4 or 5 days. I kind of kept myself in shape for the fact that, or for the option that I might go, but I was like, man, I can't let my teammates go out there and compete without me. So I suited up, and it was an awesome experience, you know, especially to win on the same day as Professor Raphael again for the second time. We were able to do that.
Yeah, that was amazing.
Absolutely incredible experience. Yeah, it was supposed to happen. I think I'd, you know, kind of hinted at that a couple of times throughout the year, and it just didn't. And now we're towards the end of the year, and you know, I just went to ADCC and No-Gi Worlds. Like, I needed a little bit of a break. Give me a little bit of
enjoy some food for a little bit.
Exactly. I've been living the good life here for. Now, I'm not even going to lie, but keep your eyes out and open for very early 2014.
But the question I had about that, you've been working on your striking, but on the mental side of things, there is a higher sense of, in a certain sense, there's a higher level of brutality, I think, in MMA. So, you know, you step in a cage, it's locked behind you. Is the mental preparation for that different than for your jiu-jitsu?
You know, that having no experience walking into a cage right now, I think that's going to be very difficult for me to say and answer. I'll tell you right now, I don't see myself approaching it any differently from the mindset that I have right now, which is you better strap yourself in because I'm going to give you everything I've got for as long as I can, for as long as the match lasts. I'm going to be coming at you, playing smart, playing forward, frustrating you, pressuring you, doing everything that I do, keeping the fight where I want to keep it, whether it is standing up, whether it is on the ground, whether it is up against the cage, like wherever I want to, I'm going to try to put it there, and I'm going to grind you out and grind you away and beat you down. And that's truly what my mindset is.
Beautiful.
Same thing that I go in there. I don't see myself approaching it any differently. I've been striking all my life. I've only just recently started doing more sparring on a consistent basis with live partners. You know, I also began in Taekwondo the same time I started wrestling. I did that for 9 years. It was very helpful in that regard. I started training a lot more Muay Thai, kind of Valet Tudo style, when I first started training at the Lovato School of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, back when Professor Raphael's father was running it, Professor Raphael Sr. And he has a very extensive martial arts background not just in jiu-jitsu, but also in Jeet Kune Do and a lot of other martial arts. So he's been a tremendous help in training my stand-up and a lot in that regard. It's been one of those things, too. A lot of people have said that my style, especially my jiu-jitsu style, will mesh and work really well with MMA. So we're going to see.
We'll see. Oh, that's awesome, man. Well, I look forward to seeing that. I have a few, like maybe five random questions that maybe you can answer with just like one word or like a sentence.
Oh, man. These are the ones I'm worst at, but I'll do my best.
All right. Well, you can pass. Anyway, do you like Game of Thrones?
Love it. Absolutely.
Who's your favorite character?
Ooh, that's a difficult one. I go back and forth. Spoiler alert if I give it away. since King Rob died, I'm back in Daenerys Targaryen.
Oh, wow. Okay, cool. A lady. Question number two. Dan Gable versus John Smith in their prime. If they had a wrestling match, who wins? So I would say John Smith is like technique and Dan Gable is grit.
Yeah. Honestly, I'm going to take the OSU head wrestling match.
That's a safe choice given that you're from Oklahoma. Good. Question number three. Is there intelligent life out there in the universe? Aliens?
No.
It's simple. Question number four. There's been a Brazilian and an American world champion in jiu-jitsu. What will be the third country from which a world champ will come?
Where is Alexander Trans from? I can't think of where he's from off the top of my head. I think he's got a really good shot.
I'm looking it up right now. Copenhagen.
Is that Denmark?
Denmark, yeah. He's got a shot.
And there, I think he's got a really good shot. I've seen a lot of good things. I think he's made big strides in his competition career this year.
So from Europe, awesome. Last question: do you have any strange pre-tournament superstitions?
No.
So you're not a superstitious guy. Okay.
Cool. No.
Awesome. Where can people follow you on Twitter and Facebook? Right.
Yeah, you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/DarthRaider86, and you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at DarthRaider86.
Is there anyone you'd like to thank?
Yeah, of course. Real quick shout-out to all my sponsors, OTM and Lucky E, Novatech Labs, PR2 Systems, and my strength and conditioning coach, Luke Tyree. And then, of course, I'd like to thank, of course, my family and my parents especially for always pushing me to be the very best that I could be and supporting me in anything and everything that I've ever set out to do. I truly wouldn't be here right now without their support. Obviously, I'd like to thank Professor Rafael Lovato Jr. For all his leadership, mentorship, and guidance throughout the years, and not just on a truly student-teacher basis, but he's also someone that I look up to like a brother to me, and his wife as well. Tina Lovato, who I look up to as like an older sister. They've been like family to me ever since I walked through the doors, and I couldn't ask any more from them, and their support means so much to me. Obviously, my high school wrestling coach, Andy Howington, who really started me down on the path of believing in myself and my own abilities. I still keep in contact with him today. I see him quite often. We're always exchanging ideas. He's always still teaching me, showing me new stuff, still beating me up as well.
Awesome.
I always appreciate those times. He's someone that I look up to. He's definitely a mentor, father figure that I have in my life. And he's always believed in me and been there for me. And him and his family both, and they've always been that way towards me. So that kind of thing is very important to me. And then, of course, all of my closest friends and my inner circle, and they know who they are.
That's awesome, man. You remember your roots. And I'd like to give a shout-out to Paul of Open Mat Radio, who's interviewed you several times, so people should check it out. You know, if you've listened this far, you should probably listen. He did some awesome interviews with you this year, last year, some good stuff.
Paul's a great guy.
Thanks so much for talking to me today. I look forward to seeing what you do in 2014.
Thanks so much. It was great being here. Thank you so much for the opportunity.